This is the RTE News at 1 with Brian Dobson. Good afternoon. The headlines this Thursday lunchtime. Families of the 48 victims of the Stardust fire are gathering at the Dublin District Coroner's Court to hear the inquest verdicts. Inspections of direct provision centres have found shortcomings in Garda vetting and management, infested living areas and overcrowding. And G7 foreign ministers are meeting to discuss ways to help Ukraine win its war against Russia. The news in detail with Brian Jennings.
Families of the Stardust victims have been arriving at the Dublin District Coroner's Court ahead of the jury's verdicts into the disaster that happened 43 years ago. 48 people aged between 16 and 27 died in a fire when the fire took hold of the Arte nightclub in the early hours of St. Valentine's Day 1981. The jury has been told there are five verdicts open to them. Accidental death, death by misadventure, unlawful killing, an open verdict and a narrative verdict, which sets out the conclusions in more detail. Eleanor Burnhill reports.
The 12-person jury, which has been told it can reach majority verdicts of at least seven people in agreement, will begin delivering them in around an hour's time at Dublin District Coroner's Court. Legal teams and families of the 48 victims of the Stardust fire began arriving at the pillar room on the grounds of the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin this morning. The inquest, which sat for over 100 days, is the longest running in Ireland to date. The results much anticipated. Families are expected to march afterwards to the Garden of Remembrance.
Inspections of direct provision centres have found shortcomings in Garda vetting and management, infested living areas and overcrowding. The findings are included in reports for the Health Information and Quality Authority, HICWA, arising from checks in January on four International Protection Accommodation Service Centres. Our social affairs correspondent, Alva Keneally.
3 months ago, HICWA assumed the function of monitoring and inspecting over 40 IPAS centres nationwide, otherwise known as direct provision. The first set of inspection reports relate to four centres located in Limerick, Clare, Kildare and Monaghan. Overcrowding, access to kitchen facilities and issues around transportation from the centres were highlighted across the reports. At two of the locations, Garda vetting was incomplete and the minutes of meetings involving management across all the centres were either scant or non-existent. Inspectors witnessed cockroaches in six family units at one centre and described the use of tented accommodation at another as a failure of human rights, stating that it didn't comply with national standards.
A 42-year-old man has been before Listowel District Court in County Kerry, charged with the murder of Thomas Dooley, a father of seven, at a graveyard in Tralee in October 2022. Daniel Dooley, of 15, on Carrageen Connolly Park, Tralee, was remanded in custody. He's the sixth person to be charged with murder in relation to the case. Our Southern editor, Pascal Sheehy.
Thomas Dooley and his wife Siobhan were attacked when they were attending the funeral of a friend at Rath Cemetery in Tralee on October 5th, 2022. Siobhan Dooley was seriously injured. Her husband Thomas died at the scene. He was a 42-year-old father of seven from Hazelwood Drive in Killarney. This morning, 42-year-old Daniel Dooley, with an address set on Carrageen Connolly Park, Tralee, was brought before the District Court in Listowel, charged with Thomas Dooley's murder. Detective Garda John Gilmartin told the court he arrested Daniel Dooley in Wilton in Cork at 7 o'clock this morning. He said, Daniel Dooley replied, I shouldn't be here, I'm an innocent man, when the charge was put to him. Daniel Dooley is the sixth person to be charged with Thomas Dooley's murder. He was remanded in custody until next Wednesday. Pascal Sheehy, RTE News, the District Court, Listowel.
The Garda Representative Association has accused the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, of not understanding the issues affecting rank and file Gardaí and of blurring the lines of separation between politics and policing. The association has described the minister's decision not to attend its annual conference because the Garda Commissioner has not been invited as regrettable and disappointing. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
First, the Commissioner Drew Harris was not invited. Then the Minister, Helen McEntee, refused to go. Now the association representing over 11,000 rank-and-file Gardaí has accused the Minister of taking sides against them with a show of solidarity and support for the Garda Commissioner. The Minister says she won't attend or address the annual GRA conference next week because attendance would undermine the office of the Commissioner, who has not been invited. But GRA President Brendan O'Connor said today that Helen McEntee has made her presence at the conference a precondition of the GRA having a better relationship with the Commissioner, and she has blurred the lines between politics and policing. He also said Helen McEntee's position is at odds with the Taoiseach's statement that he wants to support frontline Gardaí because the Minister, with direct responsibility for policing, is choosing not to do so. Paul Reynolds, RTE News at the GRA headquarters, Dublin.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant. Create a modern, minimalistic home decor look and warmth in every room with Grant Uflex underfloor heating. Visit grant.ie.
It'll be generally cloudy today with a lot of dry weather. Patchy light rain and drizzle will slowly spread from the northwest. The rain will be persistent for a time near the north coast. Highest temperatures will range from 9 to 14 degrees. Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Still to come this lunchtime, the Stardust families gather for the inquest verdicts of the 48 young people who died in the 1981 fire. We'll hear from our reporter at the coroner's court. The health regulator HICWA publishes its first reports into direct provision, identifying overcrowding, an absence of Garda vetting, and in one case, pest infestation. Radiotherapy cancer treatment machines lying idle. Radiation therapists say there's a recruitment and retention crisis in the profession. And we hear from the mum of a County Down four-year-old with epilepsy whose family travelled to Ukraine for life-changing surgery.
Your TV licence supports essential public media in Ireland. If you've recently paid your TV licence, thank you. For more, see tvlicense.ie or visit any post office. Remember, if you have a TV, you must have a TV licence. Brought to you by the Government of Ireland.
Sheer Trina Blinta, Gahajani Iwadi Gain, Er Ashtar Lon Dintishus Kultur, Trilosh Grivani, Ishoda Alina, and Chester Beery, Tour Coacher and Chester Beery in Yuv. Áitiúil an láb an uachtarig focalis alian ar imachtaimsire. Sir cead is deach. Oscail dhéanach ar gédín. Tile óris ag chesterbeatty.ie.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. In just under an hour's time, the jury in the inquest into the deaths of 48 young people who perished in the 1981 Stardust nightclub fire is expected to begin delivering its verdicts. After sitting for more than 100 days and hearing some 300 witnesses, the jury said yesterday that they'd reached majority verdicts after being advised by the coroner that they could do so. The proceedings, which have been held in the Pillar Room at the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin, began last April following a sustained campaign by relatives. Families of the victims have been arriving at the Dublin District Coroner's Court, where our reporter Conor Hunt joins us from now. Conor, I imagine a keen sense of anticipation now as the families await the verdicts very shortly.
That's right, Brian. We're just outside the courtroom at the moment. The media, of which there's a sizable number, will be let in very shortly before proceedings get underway. As you say, proceedings are going to get underway at 2 p.m. But we've been here all morning, and from mid-morning, really, the families of the victims have begun pouring in here to arrive at the court for in anticipation of these long-awaited verdicts. We saw Antoinette Keegan arrive. She, of course, was one of the survivors of the 1981 blaze, but her sisters, Mary and Martina, died. We saw the McHughes arriving, Morris and Phyllis McHugh. They had only one child, 17-year-old Caroline. She was also among one of the 48 victims. And in the last few minutes, Bridget McDermott has arrived, arrived in a car close to where the entrance of the court is. Now, Bridget McDermott is the mother of three of the McDermotts. She lost three children in the Stardust fire, Willie, George and Marcella. She's quite an elderly, frail woman. She's just gone in the last few minutes as well. Survivors too, Brian. Jimmy Fitzpatrick Patrick has arrived. He suffered serious injuries in the fire, spent a long time in hospital. And I just saw Colm O'Brien arrive in too. He was one of the DJs working on the night. He's flown in from the USA to be here today. So a lot of survivors, family members and supporters already in the courtroom.
So what about the sequence of events once the proceedings get underway at 2 o'clock, Conor? How do we expect the verdicts to be delivered? Indeed, what are the verdicts open to the jury?
Well, the choreography we won't find out really until we get inside the courtroom, to be honest, and that's going to happen around 2 o'clock. But what we do know is that the jury will deliver findings into the circumstances into the circumstances around the fire, but they'll also be giving verdicts into each individual death, the 48 victims. We believe that might be done alphabetically now, and so that could take some time. And on that front, the jurors. Have been told by the coroner previously that there are 5 available verdicts open to them: accidental death, death by misadventure, unlawful killing, a narrative verdict, and an open verdict. Now, as we've heard previously, legal teams representing the families of the victims have urged the jury in their closing submissions to return verdicts of unlawful killing, but we and the families and everyone else will find out the culmination of these proceedings in about an hour's time.
Very good. Conor Hunt at the coroner's court sitting at the Rotunda Hospital. Thank you for that. Well, Tánaiste de Mícheál Martin has told the Doyle this lunchtime that the Stardust inquest verdicts will be a huge moment for the families and for the entire country. Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty also paid tribute to the families during leaders' questions. We can hear now some of what was said in the Doyle this morning.
My thoughts, and I think all of our thoughts, are with the families of those who died in the Stardust tragedy in 1981. And for over 40 years now, the families have pursued the search for truth and justice. In a couple of hours' time, we will hear the verdict of the Dublin Coroner's Court. This will be a huge moment for the families and indeed for the entire country, because the Stardust tragedy is seared on the collective consciousness of the Irish people, and the tenacity of the families and their success in securing this inquest has been a service to all in society, and I think I would join with everyone in sharing our thoughts and with them today of all days.
My thoughts and the thoughts of the party are with the families of those who lost their lives in the Stardust fire. They have waited, as we all know, 4 decades to answers to what happened to their loved ones at that time, and they faced many, many obstacles, including those put in their way by this state. And I hope that the families involved today will get those answers that they waited for. And I extend to them my solidarity and the solidarity of everyone in Sinn Féin on this momentous day.
Piers Doherty of Sinn Féin, and full coverage of the Stardust Inquest's verdicts will be on this channel on the Liveline programme with Joe Duffy from 2 o'clock this afternoon. The independent watchdog HICWA has published its first inspection reports on centres providing accommodation for asylum seekers. The report outlines the findings of its inspectors at 4 direct provision centres in January. Inspections found overcrowding, incomplete Garda vetting and human rights issues, among other issues. For more, we can talk now to HICWA's Head of Programming for Monitoring International Protection Accommodation Service Centres, Brona Gibson, who's with us here in studio. Very good afternoon to you, Brona. Welcome to the News at 1. Overall, what is the picture to emerge in relation to these centres, the first 4 of which you're publishing reports on today?
Well, the overall picture is, Brian, that these centres are very different. They are very different in size and type and location. But they also have significant areas of improvement that are needed. And I suppose the key trends that have emerged from these centres is that the improvements needed are in relation to governance. So that will be how these centres are operated and managed in terms of risk management. So that would be how safe the service is in terms of safeguarding. So is that how well people are protected who live there? And lastly, in terms of promoting people's human rights. And you'll see from some of our report, from the individual reports, that this, while this varied to different extents across each of the centres, there are some quite prolific findings in relation to some of the centres. One in particular had, as was mentioned in your lead-in there, a pest control issue, and this infestation was actually witnessed by our inspectors in six independent living units and identified then in 13 other units. And while this provider had taken measures in the past, they just weren't enough and it didn't get rid of the problem. So we issued an urgent compliance plan. That meant that they had to take immediate action, really, to sort this issue out. In another...
That was St. Patrick's Accommodation Centre in County Monaghan.
It was, yes.
Then more generally, what about the living conditions in the centres? Did you find significant evidence of overcrowding, for example?
Well, certainly there's evidence of overcrowding, even in the smaller centres, so it wasn't confined to the size of the centre. We found people sharing a room with three other people, and these would be strangers. They don't know each other. And those people could change over time. So if one person moves out, another person moves in. And you could imagine dressing in front of strangers and having no privacy and your dignity seriously not promoted in those types of arrangements.
And in the centre in County Clare, for example, Knockaleeshan, the situation there compounded by the fact that there were residents living in tents.
Yes, there were 13 military-style tents on the grounds of Knockaleeshan Accommodation Centre, and they could each hold eight people. And our inspectors went into these tents and found really poor living conditions for the people there. There were 52 men living in these tents. They had nowhere to put their clothes. They literally had a bed. Their clothes were lying on the floor. There were damp towels, for example. They'd nowhere to hang them. There was a constant heat blower going all of the time. You can imagine being in a tent when the wind is blowing, constant noise, flapping noise. The door at the into the tents are canvas, so they can't be secured. They're not solid doors, so there's constant movement. And what the residents in there told us, what the people living in those tents told us, that this really affected their mental health, their physical health. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, when you take these are clearly, this is a situation where people's rights cannot be promoted and their basic needs cannot be met. And we met one man, for example, who was 9 days in the centre and didn't know that he could walk across to the actual main building and get food. We met another man while this arrangement was said to be a temporary arrangement. We met a man who was living there for 9 months. That certainly wasn't a temporary arrangement for him. And in this type of situation, you would expect that a provider, while it's an operational reality in this centre, that they would go over and above to make these people as comfortable as possible and have their rights promoted as well as they can, and that certainly wasn't the case.
I mean, as you've indicated, you spoke to residents and you spoke also to some of the children in the centres, and in one case, mm-hmm. Children telling you that they had to do their homework on the floor, lying on the floor. I mean, that's heartbreaking to read.
Yeah, and children are great because they actually tell you how things actually are. And they did. They said that they would have liked more room, more space to do their homework. We saw children living in conditions where they really didn't have enough room to move around. And if you think of young children developing their motor skills, that wasn't an ideal situation for them.
In terms particularly of safety of children and perhaps vulnerable adults as well, mm-hmm. what is the picture in relation to Garda vetting of staff working in centres?
Well, one of the centres had 10 people who had yet to have any Garda check carried out on them. You know, and from a HICRA's perspective, this is a fundamental safeguard when you're providing services to potentially vulnerable people, including children and vulnerable adults. So we issued urgent compliance plans to any of the centres where this wasn't the case. But again, it is a fundamental safeguard, and our message to any provider out there who's providing an accommodation centre is, get your staff vetted, have international police checks carried out for staff who've lived outside of the country before that you brought them into your employment. And also basic things like if you're taking on new member staff, make sure you get references. So these are the kinds of deficits that we found in the centres.
And there's more besides, but what about taking action to rectify some of this? What can you do to ensure that these non-compliant areas are made compliant?
Well, how HICWA monitors is we do our inspection, we publish our report, we get a compliance plan from the providers, and then we hold them to what they've committed to in those plans. So we continuously monitor, we go out, we'll revisit these centres time and time again, and we'll get assurances that the actions that they said that they will take will actually happen.
And there's more reports in the pipeline, more inspections have been carried
out. Absolutely. This is the first four reports in a series of reports that will be published by HICWA in the coming weeks.
Very good. Thanks indeed for joining us. Brona Gibson there from HICWA. The Garda Representative Association has said it's disappointed and confused by a decision from Justice Minister Helen McEntee to refuse an invitation to their annual conference in Mayo next week because the GRA had not invited Garda Commissioner Drew Harris. The GRA voted not to invite Mr. Harris in February, citing, quote, a breakdown in trust. Minister McEntee says she's engaged with the GRA and asked them to reconsider and that it would not now be appropriate to attend and would undermine the office of the Garda Commissioner if she was indeed to attend the GRA conference. Our crime correspondent, Paul Runs, has been following the story. The minister made her decision, made her announcement this morning, Paul, and then there was a response from the GRA.
Yeah, quite a robust response, Brian, from the GRA in a statement and then in a number of interviews this morning. They have accused the minister of taking sides against them with, quote, a show of solidarity and support for the Garda Commissioner. The GRA say that the minister, Helen McEntee, has made her presence at conference a precondition of the GRA having a better relationship with the commissioner and that she has blurred the lines between politics and policing, which they say is a key element in any democracy to ensure the independence and legitimacy of policing. Now, the GRA president, Brendan O'Connor, also said that Helen McEntee's position is at odds with the Taoiseach's statement that he wants to support frontline Gardaí because he says the minister with direct responsibility for policing is choosing not to do so, not to support frontline Gardaí by refusing to attend their annual conference.
So where then, Paul, does this relieve relations between rank and file Gardaí and the minister and indeed the commissioner?
Well, the GRA see it as a snub, and the minister has shown she's not prepared, because they say the minister has shown she's not prepared to listen to them. They say they have issues with pay, pensions, recruitment, retention, crime, public safety, and resources and support for the Gardaí. And they say these are the issues that will be raised at their conference next week, and the minister will not be there to address their concerns. And they stress that while the commissioner, who they have not invited to the conference, is responsible for operational policing, the role of the minister is different, because the minister is responsible for legislation and policy. Now, the minister, for her part, has already said she'll continue to engage with the GRA and she's absolutely committed to making progress on the issues facing the men and women of An Garda Síochána Síochána. But the GRA's relations have already been damaged with the commissioner for some time. They say trust has broken down and they say relations now have also been damaged with the minister and that her action also raises the question of trust.
Paul Reynolds, crime correspondent, thanks for that. The Irish Institute of Radiographers and Radiation Therapists says it does not want to see machines that deliver radiotherapy treatment to cancer patients lying idle due to staff shortages. The professional body says a review being carried out into recruitment and retention problems needs to be completed and its recommendations implemented without delay. We've been speaking to Ruth Woods, council member with the Institute, about these machines which have been laid up.
So at the moment, yes, there are machines that are not being used and it's primarily due to radiation therapist staffing shortages. So there's two machines in across the St. Luke's Radiation Oncology Network, so it's 2 out of 14. And then there's one treatment machine in Cork, 1 out of 5 is not being fully utilised, and one CT scanner, which is used for the planning of radiotherapy, isn't being fully utilised. And in Galway, the fourth treatment machine there that was commissioned, they're struggling to fully utilise that as well due to staffing, and there's a CT scanner that's not being fully utilised due to staffing as well.
What are the implications of that for patients? Because as I understand it, maybe half of people who have a cancer diagnosis will be recommended for a radiation treatment.
Just to go back, radiotherapy is one of the three types of the three main types of treatments for patients with cancer, and around 50% of patients will need radiotherapy. And I suppose what radiation therapists do, we're the profession who work as part of the multidisciplinary team to care for those patients who are having radiotherapy. So we use really big, large, complex treatment machines and scanning machines and software to plan and deliver mm-hmm. that radiotherapy. Mm-hmm. So I suppose if there's treatment machines closed, it's reducing the capacity to take patients into the system. I know anywhere there are machine closures, there's a lot of triaging work to make sure that the patients who need, you know, treatment soon get treatment within, you know, recommended clinical timeframes. And or the hospitals are accessing some treatments in the private sector, and also the radiation therapists who are still working are doing overtime as well to mitigate kind of any clinical impact to patients.
Is there though a risk that for some patients their treatment will be delayed?
Yes, there is, but I suppose there's careful consideration to make sure that those patients, you know, that we get patients in and started within good, you know, timeframes in terms of their clinical outcomes. So they might feel that it's a little bit delayed, but it's not going to negatively impact them. But I suppose it's a concern for radiation therapists and a concern for the, you know, for the professional body. We don't want to see treatment machines lying idle because there aren't enough staff to work on them.
And that is the problem. It's staff recruitment and retention and staff training, the training of radiation therapists.
In terms of retention, we're losing radiation therapists from Ireland, but we're also losing radiation therapists from the profession. And obviously those who are still in the profession are very much doing their best. And I think on a job basis, it's a rewarding job, but it's not necessarily a rewarding career. There's maybe a lack of variety in the career, and the structure really isn't there for people to progress, but also while still working clinically. And departments, I think, really very much want this, but there is a lean model in terms of the staffing model that makes it impossible really to implement change on that kind of local level. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, there's all the pressures in terms of retention that other hospitals in cities face. Radiotherapy is only delivered in cities, so you have to live in a city and cost of living and, you know, and pay and all that kind of thing come into it as well.
We're familiar in a lot of other areas as well. But in terms of the training throughput, are enough radiation therapists being trained each year?
It's a small profession, so there are a small number of radiation therapists being trained. There's 42 places offered across two universities, so there's a postgraduate qualification that you can get from University College Cork, and then there's an undergraduate that you can get from Trinity College Dublin. It's a 4-year program, and I suppose there's attrition both within those programs as well, because people don't see it potentially as a long-term career option for them. Just in terms of recruitment as well, we do struggle to recruit internationally. We're a regulated profession from the regulator CORU, and so there are kind of constraints in that. We used to traditionally get people coming from overseas, New Zealand, Australia, coming over, working a year and maybe going back, but that does seem to have, you know, dried up.
How many more radiation therapists would it take to get these machines we've been talking about back up and running?
So it's hard to put a number on it, but there's, I suppose, to increase student places, things like practice tutors are needed, but I suppose I think roles like that will benefit both recruitment and retention, because I think a lot of the issue around the career is the lack of career progression, lack of variety. But if there were roles like a practice tutor, well, then that gives variety to, you know, the person who's actually in the role. So that means they're more likely to stay while benefiting, being able to increase number of clinical placements, so increasing numbers of students in. So it's those kind of roles. It's a win-win situation then for both kind of retention and recruitment. Say, for example, if a department in Ireland had 32 funded posts, that same department in Australia would have 48, and the UK would have 54 funded radiation therapist posts. So we're lean to begin with, but then we have our vacancies on top of that. So it makes for a very difficult place to work, I suppose.
Ruth Woods from the Institute of Radiographers and Radiation Therapists. The HSE has said the shortage of radiation therapists is an ongoing issue nationally and internationally. It said 20 new posts were allocated here since 2019, and work is underway to reduce registration time by CORO for radiation therapists who qualify outside the state. A task force has been set up to deal with ongoing discoloration in Cork City's water supply. The issue has been caused by iron and manganese disturbed in the city's pipes during ongoing repair and upgrade works. Ish Gairn has said that the reports of such issues have reduced since they peaked in October and are closer to what might be associated with an aged network such as that in Cork. However, the utility is advising residents not to drink discoloured water and to contact them if issues persist. Joining me on the line now is Green Party Cork City Councillor Oliver Moran. Oliver, thanks for taking our call this lunchtime. So, I mean, this is a problem that first emerged, was it last autumn, but has persisted?
It certainly was reached breaking point last autumn for a lot of people, but it's going on for nearly 2 years now. It's associated with upgrades to water treatment plants near the city and other works that took place. And what has happened is that this has stirred up naturally occurring iron and manganese in quite old city mains networks. And unfortunately, it's continued now for about 2 years with the manganese stirred up, and it's with the resulting effect that it can unfortunately come out through people's taps through discoloured water. And when it does, it is certainly not safe to drink. And it's quite unpredictable for households. So somebody could be affected this week. They might be fine for another couple of weeks. I could be affected today. My neighbour could be unaffected. And it's been like this for 2 years with the resulting consequences for people who want to do their cooking or to do washing and so on.
Across how widespread an area?
Oh, it is across the entire city. It in some ways, it seems to be concentrated on the north side of the city, but there's also areas up the south side of the city that are affected as well. Now, the initial response from Ish Gairn was what they describe as flushing. So that is essentially allowing the water mains to flow out onto the street and take the sediment with it. That had a kind of a hit and miss effect. Look, it really for the people who were affected, it didn't have the effect needed. Now, I had a sit down meeting with them yesterday, and my interest really in that meeting was to establish that the task force that was set up in February was established, and that it was working. And to be fair to them, I left that meeting very confident that they are working hard on it. But unfortunately, no end is really in sight. Mm-hmm. And I know what you've just said about the number of complaints having been reduced, but realistically, I think that's down to fatigue from households in complaining about the issue.
Yeah, so I mean, what is the task force doing? What can it do?
So what I discovered yesterday, like I said, they initially took the approach of what is described as flushing, which is a kind of a method of going through the line one section at a time and trying to flush out this sediment. Now, that didn't have as much of an effect as people would have wanted it to. But what I discovered yesterday is that they're now developing a more nuanced system, which they have been trialling in the Douglas area. And that's is about trying to understand the way that the sediment is flowing within the mains pipes and then making adjustments so that it finds its natural level. This is something that would naturally be in cast iron pipes anyway, just ordinarily it would sit at the bottom of the pipe and wouldn't be disturbed, and its problem now is that it's being disturbed. So we want to get it back to that natural level. But in order to do this, it's really important that people keep reporting incidents, because it's that data is actually what's driving the response.
So don't become weary and give up. We'll leave it there. Councillor Oliver Moran from the Green Party, thanks very much indeed for that. Back with more after this short break.
Hi, Ian Dempsey here. Special Olympics Ireland needs your help. I've seen the joy, opportunity and community that Special Olympics provides for athletes with an intellectual disability. But we need your support to make this happen. Head to specialolympics.ie or donate on Revolut. Let's show them our support and make their dreams a reality.
RTE Radio 1.
Peppa Pig, George and family are back in a brand new stage show. Peppa Pig's Fun Day Out. Live at 3 Olympia on Saturday, May 11th and Sunday, May 12th. Get ready to sing and dance with colourful scarecrows, feed the penguins and build big sandcastles. Peppa's Fun Day Out. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie.
Entertainment updates on RTE Radio 1.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. A four-year-old girl from County Down is recovering after undergoing complex brain surgery in Ukraine. Rachel Gribben suffers from a severe form of epilepsy, which led to multiple seizures and serious developmental issues. The local community in Killyleagh helped raise the funds for the surgery in Ukraine after doctors in the UK decided not to operate on Rachel. Her mum, Kate, has been telling us how Rachel ended up having her operation in Ukraine.
Originally, she was referred to Manchester Children's Hospital and Alder Hey. They have a team, a combined team of neurosurgeons, because we don't have neurosurgery in Northern Ireland. So there's no, you know, no neurosurgery here. So she was referred to the team there. She was meant to have had some tests, you know, pretty much straight away to see if she was a candidate for surgery. Unfortunately, once she had these tests, they came to the conclusion that she wasn't a candidate for surgery now. Me being stubborn, received the news that she wasn't a candidate for surgery and that it was just going to be medication and possibly a device called a VNS. I decided that I wasn't willing to accept that. I'd done lots of research. I joined lots of different forums on Facebook and support groups and paediatric epilepsy surgery. A name kept on coming up, Dr. Luke Tmyich from New Jersey. Now, he's the director of the Epilepsy Institute there. And I thought to myself, well, who better than someone that runs a hospital dedicated to epilepsy? So I got in touch with him and he got back in touch with me straight away. And we discussed Rachel's case, had a couple of Zoom meetings. He was pretty confident that he could do something for Rachel down, you know, the surgery route and try and give her some seizure freedom. Mm. The only option thing with that is that going to America was going to be at least £100,000 minimum.
Mm.
And that was something we're never going to be able to do, even with fundraising, you know. It's an awful lot of money. But then he notified me that he actually goes to Ukraine, to Lviv, every year, works with their neurosurgeons, treating epilepsy, bringing on, you know, their technology there. He's a big advocate for epilepsy surgery, which is something that's really underutilized across the world.
So Ukraine then became an option, but I presume you had a lot of questions about how safe it would be traveling to a country that's in war.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when he first said traveling to Ukraine, I must admit, I kind of laughed at him. And then, you know, he was reassuring me that Lviv was perfectly safe. And, you know, he said, you know, I mean, his words were everybody's going about their daily business. Mm-hmm. He's traveling there with his own family.
So you were
every year, and
you were reassured, obviously.
Yeah, reassured. Yeah. really reassured. This,
but you still found yourself, I think, on one occasion taking shelter in the bomb shelter under the hospital.
Yes. So the air raid sirens were pretty much daily. First time we arrived in Ukraine on the 19th March. She started testing straight away that evening, and then on Friday night we were awoken in the middle of the night with sirens and were moved to a corridor in the middle of the hospital away from windows and such, with the possibility of being moved to the bunker, which was the basement floor of the hospital. Being down there was very, very daunting. I had seen all the beds and everything lined up against the corridors and everything down there ready, and then even being moved to, you know, what they call the safe zone before needing to be moved to the actual bunker was just so, at first, very, very scary. You know, hearing those sirens, thinking, oh my gosh, what's happening? This is the first time we've heard sirens, and it was horrifying.
Well, obviously you're concerned for Rachel, concerned about the surgery and also facing this situation as well. But the surgery did go ahead, Katie, and it's been a success.
It's been a fabulous success, an absolute fabulous success. She's got 4 weeks on Friday post-op and 4 weeks seizure-free. So it's a massive, massive success. And to think that war-torn Ukraine had time to treat a little girl from Killyleagh, it's just amazing.
Katie Jennings there, mum of four-year-old Rachel, who's recovering after that surgery. Gardaí have arrested two men as part of a major international fraud investigation. Operation Stargrew targeted people suspected of being involved in organised fraud, where bulk phishing or smishing text messages are sent out, designed to deceive people into providing their personal data and credentials for the purposes of fraud. Many of these purport to be from banks and other service providers. Well, let's talk to our work and technology correspondent, Brian O'Donovan, who has the story. So what are the details of this investigation and these arrests, Brian?
Well, Brian, under Operation Stargrew, law enforcement agencies from 19 countries were involved in disrupting what was described as one of the world's largest phishing as a service platforms known as LabHost. Now, phishing and smishing, as you said there, involves the sending out of fraudulent emails or texts, effectively trying to trick people into disclosing their personal information, such as their banking details. Now, LabHost was this online platform that allowed cyber criminals to deploy phishing websites that are then used to steal victims' data and credentials for the purposes of fraud. Now, this LabHost website, it has now been shut down, and that's the culmination of a year-long operation coordinated at the international level by Europol. Now, here in Ireland, Gardaí say that they suspect there is around 116 users of this LabHost service that have connections to Ireland, and they've identified more than 150,000 instances of people responding to phishing links suspected to be associated with those 116 users.
So is that it, or does the investigation continue?
Investigation ongoing, and certainly from an Irish perspective, there's been quite a lot of activity as well, Brian. So Gardaí, in conjunction with Europol and some of their other international law enforcement agencies, conducted 12 searches at locations in Dublin, Kildare and Waterford yesterday and on Tuesday. Now, during these searches, €42,000 in cash, was €10,000 in cryptocurrency, smartphones, computers, tablet devices and a Rolex watch. Two men were arrested during the course of the operation. One of them has been charged and will appear before the courts at a future date. Now, just this lunchtime, Brian, Bank of Ireland has issued a statement congratulating Gardaí and the international authorities for this operation. The bank described LabHost as a website which facilitated fraud attacks on a global scale. Bank of Ireland saying Irish consumers will be safer as a result of today's actions, which is something that is very welcome.
Brian O'Donovan, work and technology correspondent, thanks very much for that. Former RTE presenter and producer Alf McCarthy has died after a short illness. He was 73. Alf's broadcasting career spanned 35 years, including a stint as presenter of Late Date on this channel up to his retirement 9 years ago. Here, in memory of a great radio man, is his sign-off from that last programme in December 2015.
Thank you, my friends, for your company and for your texts and messages tonight and all this week in particular. It's been an honour and a privilege to broadcast. I leave you with a smile.
The late Alf McCarthy and our thoughts with his family and friends on this sad day.
Sport on RTE Radio 1.
Good afternoon to John Kennedy. John.
Good afternoon to you, Brian. Sam Monaghan's out of the Ireland team for Saturday's Women's Six Nations game against England at Twickenham. The co-captain missed the opening game against France last month due to a concussion, but returned for round two against Italy and played in the win over Wales last weekend. The absence of Monaghan is one of two changes to the team that started in the victory over Wales. Aoife Dalton will partner Eve Higgins in the centre, and Enya Breen will drop to the bench. Hannah O'Connor comes into the second row to partner Dorothy Wall. Live radio coverage of the game here over the weekend on Saturday Sport on RTE Radio 1. Rory McIlroy, Shane Lowry and Seamus Power all in the field for the first round of the RBC Heritage in South Carolina. That's on the US PGA Tour. Meanwhile, Leona Maguire and Stephanie Meadow are the two Irish players in the field for the opening major of the women's golf season. The Chevron Championship gets underway today at the Woodlands in Texas. Liverpool face a huge task to overturn their Europa League quarterfinal first leg defeat by the Italian side Atalanta, with Liverpool trailing 3-0 heading into the away leg in Bergamo today. West Ham are 2-0 down from the first leg in Germany. They host the Bundesliga champions Bayer Leverkusen. In the Conference League, Aston Villa will bring a 2-1 lead to France for the second leg against Lille. And Cricket Ireland are due to announce their 2024 fixtures after a board meeting today, and the meeting is finally likely to clarify budgets surrounding fixtures and contracts for players, men and women. The Ireland's men's side have already qualified for the T20 finals in June in the USA and the Caribbean. The women's side will attempt to do likewise in the qualifiers in the UAE.